Last weekend, my wife Caroline and I joined the great annual autumn exodus. Thousands upon thousands of anxious parents in cars overloaded with household goods and topped off with one or two hyperactive teenagers. If you haven't already guessed, we were trekking across the country to take our oldest daughter, Lily, to university for the first time. Inevitably, that experience has made us think about the contrast between what it was like for us roughly 30 years ago when we were students, and the changes are quite incredible. Back then, we made lecture notes in pen and ink on lined paper. Study meant going to the library, reading books, and making notes in pen and ink on lined paper. No internet, no Wikipedia, no e-journals, no online resources, no laptops. We wrote essays and exams in pen and ink on lined paper. Computers were only just beginning to be generally available, so for very special occasions, we might book a place in the computer room to type up and print out our work. No mobile phones, no email, no Facebook, no iMessaging. If we wanted to get in touch with a friend, we cycled round to their room, knocked on their door, or left a handwritten note in their pigeonhole. There were payphones to ring home on, but a lot of us still wrote letters in pen and ink on lined paper. Now, from the perspective of universities themselves, such changes only scratch the surface. In 1990, there were 46 universities teaching about 350,000 students. Now there are over 140 British higher education institutions with over 2 million students, and almost a quarter of them are from outside the United Kingdom. Teaching and research are regularly assessed by government bodies to see how far they measure up to the claims to international excellence, claims which are liberally scattered over the carefully marketed front pages of every university website. Every year, students are given the chance to evaluate their courses for the quality of the student experience. And after all, they are paying for it. The average British student now graduates with a debt of over £50,000. Stephen Collini has called the modern university the global multiversity. Collini draws attention to the way in which academic disciplines have become increasingly specialised and split apart from each other. Academics have stopped talking to their colleagues in the department next door. Instead, we relate electronically to the global community of experts in our field. International league tables reflect the fact that students and staff are increasingly mobile across national boundaries. It's not even really about physical mobility anymore. The epitome of the global multiversity is the MOOC, the massive open online course. This allows thousands of anonymous participants anywhere in the world to sign up for a carefully pre-packaged unit of knowledge of their choice. Many of us at universities look on all this with a growing sense of disquiet. And I don't think that's simply the discomfort of increasing workloads and enhanced accountability. Something quite profound is happening to what we think universities are for. In Stephen Collini's eyes, the fundamental problem is marketization. Universities have increasingly been subjected by governments of both parties to the logic of free market economics. We have become business enterprises run by senior managers offering educational products to student consumers who take loans to invest in their future careers. Courses which fail to offer value for money ought to collapse under the pressures of competition. Even our research and the allocation of research funding is made subordinate to the demonstration of impact. That is, what we must value is socio-economic benefit over and beyond the inherent quality of the work itself. Collini credits the 19th century scholar and priest John Henry Newman with having seen these developments well in advance. At one point, Newman warns about the university becoming a, and I quote, bazaar or pantechnicon in which wares of all kinds are heaped up together for sale in stalls independent of each other. It was remarkably prescient. But not everyone would point the finger at governments besotted with economic efficiency and value for money. Joanna Williams argues that the pursuit of knowledge is being stifled in the modern university, not by external regulation, but by internal constraint. The internal constraint of an increasingly intolerant postmodernism. In her account, we're experiencing a new fear of knowledge. What is ironically called critical theory has ceased to be truly critical and has attached itself to certain controversial political and moral values. It has then abandoned the normal canons of rational argument as truth has become subordinate to its own vision, its own oppressive vision of social justice. Now, this is a cultural shift which affects students as much as staff. No one can have failed to notice the new censoriousness of Generation Z. Student unions demand trigger warnings and safe spaces. Platforms are denied to the wrong sort of progressive liberal. And ethics committees block research, which might undermine its ideological preference. Thou shalt not be too controversial. Now, wherever we point the finger, we are left with this basic question, aren't we? What does it mean to pursue knowledge in the modern secular university? For I take it as axiomatic that fundamentally the pursuit of knowledge is the reason for our existence. Whatever other purposes a university exists for, and it does exist for many, the fundamental mark that makes a university different from any other human institution is that it is committed to the pursuit of knowledge. That's the core rationale. Whatever other purposes they serve, our degrees, our academic roles, our accolades, must be steps up and into a community and tradition of scholarship. If that gets decentered, if it gets sidelined, we may call ourselves a university, we may confer things called degrees, but we have in substance become something else. So the question for us this morning is, what can we as Christians offer to this question of what it means to pursue knowledge in the modern secular university? Well, the first thing I suggest is a slight adjustment to our concept of knowledge. Shortly before our reading from Colossians, the second reading, the Apostle Paul uses a trilogy of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. In his letters, Paul uses those terms pretty much interchangeably. But if we had to pick one central biblical term of the three, it would be wisdom, not knowledge. Wisdom is supreme, therefore get wisdom. That was Proverbs chapter 4, verse 7, attributed to Solomon, the king renowned for his wisdom. We read in 1 Kings 4:29 that Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. His fame spread to surrounding nations. So Solomon was a four-star man. Those of you in university will know what I mean. World-leading in his originality, rigor, and significance in his research. His international students, particularly the Queen of Sheba, rated him excellent in teaching. And his influence on the built environment of Jerusalem just cried out for an impact case study. Notice that Solomon's wisdom was not simply a quality of his just government. I quote again, he described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also taught about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. If there are any biological scientists here this morning, Solomon is the founding father of your discipline. And in chapter 8 of the Proverbs of Solomon that we had read to us a moment ago in two sections, we have this wonderfully comprehensive vision of wisdom. Wisdom personified as a beautiful woman standing in the closest possible relationship to God himself. Wisdom loves truth and detests wickedness, verse 7. She's more precious than silver, choice gold or rubies, verse 10. She offers counsel and sound judgment, verse 14. She's good for lawyers. By me kings reign and rulers issue decrees. By me princes govern and nobles, all who rule. The politicians love her. With her are riches and honor, enduring wealth and prosperity, verse 18. That should please the economists. And then in verses 22 to 29, we have this panoramic vision of the creative work of God, the creative action of God in the natural world. Wisdom saw the stars and the planets, the mountains and the oceans, the fields and the rivers being formed. She was there and she saw it all. Then I was constantly at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in the human race. This is a wonderfully rich, comprehensive understanding of wisdom. It covers every area of knowledge, the natural sciences, the social sciences, the humanities, and it's a fundamentally humane vision, because wisdom is presented to us not as an abstract set of propositions or truths. No, wisdom is a person, and it's a joyful, playful vision. There's a little phrase there in verse 30, you may have noticed it, then I was constantly at his side. The NIV revisers have copped out at this point. There is a word in the original which no one knows how to translate. It only appears at that point in the Old Testament. The older translations translate it craftsman. Then I was constantly the craftsman at his side, and no doubt in the interests of gender equality they've removed that. The word could be translated young girl, or playmate, or daughter. Then I was the darling at his side. The image here is perhaps of a child playing with her father who has just given her the entire universe to play with. If you're in a university, you want to get wisdom. Now, this theologically centered vision of wisdom has a critical edge. It has consequences. It means, first of all, that as Christians we stand against any sort of reductionism. You might think of this as the temptation of the sciences. What I mean is the temptation to explain all phenomena in terms of one level of description. So everything gets reduced to social contribution, social construction. It gets reduced to evolutionary processes. It gets reduced to neuronal responses or reduced to molecular interactions. Depending on whatever your particular discipline is, it gets reduced to that. No. God is bigger than any one scientific perspective. If we're to get wisdom, we will be comfortable with, we will celebrate thick, multi-layered descriptions of reality, because the nature of reality is ultimately personal. It means I love you is as real as, and even more than, the adoption of social conventions, or the release of hormones, or the subconscious desire to perpetuate my DNA. They're all true, and they are all inadequate. So one thing we do is we stand against scientific reductionism. We also stand against epistemological relativism. This, I think, is the temptation of the humanities. What do I mean? Epistemological relativism says that there is really no such thing as knowledge. They're just perspectives. And often as not, perspectives offered in pursuit of oppressive goals. So unmasking the power struggle is all we can do. And even then, we find it is mask upon mask upon mask. An infinite regress of surface. No. We must be boldly and unrelentingly theocentric. Granted there is human corruption, granted there is self-interest, granted the route to knowledge is full of blind alleys and wearisome detours, but first of all, before we say anything else as Christian academics, we say this: there is God. and in his presence we know nothing. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It's still true. So if we're going to get wisdom, we stand against scientific reductionism, reducing everything to one level of explanation. We stand against relativism, saying there's no such thing as knowledge, there's just perspectives. We also stand against economic instrumentalism. Is this the temptation of the social sciences? I think it might be. It's certainly the pressure of our political environment. What are universities for? Are they for maximizing economic prosperity? No. Fundamentally, they are for the same thing, exactly the same thing, as the whole of human existence, to bring glory to God and enjoy him forever. John Goldingay points out that Proverbs 8 may well have a demythologizing agenda. The point of the poet is perhaps that wisdom is not a goddess. There's a denial there. Wisdom is not a goddess to be worshipped by her devotees. She's not one object in a pantheon of human goods. She is subordinate to the one and only true God. Doesn't our fixation on economic growth also need demythologizing? It is our number one public idol, after all. And sure, wealth is good, but it's not God. No, wisdom finds joy in contemplating. Let's not be too passive here. Wisdom finds joy in playing with all the works of God. That is the ultimate point of it, not just getting rich. Finding and communicating a little bit of the joy of playing with the works of God is the most precious part of the privilege of teaching. It's what keeps us going as researchers and scholars. It is a taste of God himself. So get wisdom. Get wisdom. What about Jesus? Where does he fit into all of that? You may remember there was a time when Jesus was rebuking the religious leaders of his day for their lack of faith. It's recorded for us in Matthew chapter 12. And Jesus said this, "The Queen of Sheba will rise at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now one greater than Solomon is here." We can imagine the religious leaders around him going, "What? What? You, the carpenter from Nazareth? You, the self-taught itinerant rabbi? You, greater than Solomon?" And the Apostle Paul says, "Yes. Yes, indeed. Greater than Solomon. Much, much greater." Our second reading came from Colossians, that letter to a young church in the center of Asia Minor. We can't be sure exactly what the problem is that Paul is addressing in this letter. It might be an excessive focus on Jewish ritual. It might be the pressure to conform to pagan rites. It might be some mixture of the two. We don't know. But whatever the problem was, Paul's diagnosis and cure is clear enough. The church in Colossae needs a clearer vision of just how great Jesus is. You see, Paul has come to see, and he wants all people to see, that this man, now born as this human being, is none other than the wisdom of Proverbs 8. That's the point of those words. The poetic metaphor written all those years ago about wisdom, the person, the beautiful woman. This has proved to be literally true. Jesus Christ is the one who stood at the side of the Father before all things. He is the one by whom and for whom all things were created. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. If you really want to get wisdom, says Paul, the sort of wisdom Solomon was talking about in Proverbs 8, you have to get Jesus. As he says a little later on, in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And this is only the half of it. It's only the half of it, because halfway through this amazing little hymn in praise of Jesus, Paul puts a massive, great, big and. Did you notice it in verse 18? And he is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead. He has the supremacy in everything. Paul wants us to see that that Jesus is much more than the wisdom who stands at the side of the Father. He's also the one whose body was broken to heal this broken world. He's the one through whom all things once alienated are being reconciled. The peace which he brings extends to the whole of creation. It's not just a spiritual reconciliation to God on the part of human beings. It's the hope of everything. The hope of a physical recreation of the entire universe so that we might in time come into our full rights as children of God. If you want to get wisdom, not just the divine wisdom that permeates the entire created order, but the wisdom that has started to recreate it and which will one day reach a glorious climax when all things are renewed, you have to get Jesus. Now, if we can get our heads around this, it will transform our understanding of university life. There are so many implications, but I want to just make three in closing. You and I know, and in fact the writer of Proverbs knows, that the real world is far nastier than Proverbs 8 lets on. Proverbs 8 gives us this wonderfully sunny view of the entirety of created life. But we know that there is disease, there is pain, there is cruelty and injustice. So what do we do? Do we close our eyes to the real world around us and bravely cling to its joyful pursuit of knowledge against all the odds? Or will we wake from that dream to a cold morning of despair? You see, that is the choice that faces so many of our colleagues. They look at the world, and if they hope at all, they hope without reason. Yet because of the reconciling work of Jesus Christ, we Christians can dare to open our eyes and say yes. We can be, of all people, both realists and optimists. We don't have to choose. Whatever the pressures, whatever the odds, whatever the mess we face in this world, there is a constant inward refreshing as God's Spirit whispers in our hearts that the renewal of all things is still to come. So we have hope, and hope with reason. And secondly, this: if we claim to be Christians in a university, we cannot fail to spend some time in working out how our faith relates to our study. I remember speaking to a Christian colleague once. He was a rather senior company law lecturer. I was a junior lecturer at the time, and I gave him a paper a friend of mine had written from a Christian perspective, critical of modern corporate structures. And he gave it back to me with the comment that it was, in his view, completely misconceived. There was no connection between Christianity and company law. They had nothing to do with each other. Really? Jesus has nothing to say about the structures which enable senior managers to be environmentally irresponsible with his world and idle shareholders to get rich in the process? Really? Nothing at all to say about that? Of course he does. Now, whatever level we're at, whether you're a student just starting out or a professor on the point of retirement, Jesus is all wisdom. He is all knowledge. He's even bigger than Proverbs 8. There's always more to learn about your academic discipline and about him and how the two relate. So take some time to join up the dots. As the modern secular university loses its way intellectually, and it might be, this is going to be more important than ever. And finally this: academic life can be pretty brutal at times, in an elegant and restrained way, of course. But the competition for grants, the struggle to get one's ideas accepted, the constant evaluation and assessment that's going on can be very tough. And after all, we're trained up to be critical, aren't we? And boy, does that feel good sometimes, sinking your teeth into a colleague. But it also hurts. And the shape of Christian service is given not by that, but by the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We are not in universities, or for that matter in any other workplace or at home or anywhere, for ourselves alone. And I think this is something really very important to tell us about how we relate to our colleagues. It's about serving them. And that means putting their projects first, showing willingness to take the back seat, the slow train on our own careers. And you know, this speaks as much to those of us who are in support staff positions as well as those who are active researchers and teachers. University management too often now apes corporate machismo. It's relentlessly upbeat and quietly self-aggrandizing. But you know, good administration, and that word administration is a precious word, it's one to be cherished. Administration is quite literally an act of service. It's a real gift to others. Jesus says that it is in losing ourselves for his sake that we find life, and life in all its fullness. And that too is a gift of his wisdom to us. So may we be people who are increasingly bringing to our universities, to our colleagues, and to our students a taste of that fullness of life. Amen.